went through the classical bosonic string in some detail, and today we're going to look at how to quantize it. So today's lecture is quantization of the bosonic string. So we'll start with looking at the canonical quantization of this simple two-dimensional field theory that I wrote down yesterday. From that, we'll see by imposing these mass shell constraints that I talked about, we'll start constructing the physical string spectrum of states. We'll then move on and look at what is the analog of the operator state correspondence for string theory. This will introduce a class of operators known as vertex operators. I'll then go through a very heuristic, non-technical description of what the string perturbation expansion looks like. And then we'll finish off with showing how to include non-abelian gauge degrees of freedom into string theory. This introduces things called Chan-Peyton factors. So to get you off early morning, we'll start with an exercise. The exercise is as follows. It's just the basic setup for canonical quantization. So yesterday we wrote down the Polyakov action, and I emphasized that it was a very simple action when you wrote it in the conformal gauge. Very simple, just a free two-dimensional field theory. And that means that the canonical quantization of it is extremely simple. So the first part of the exercise is just go in the standard way and figure out what the Hamiltonian is. And in terms of these mode expansions that I wrote down yesterday, it looks like this. There are two cases, of course, for open and closed strings. The difference being, in the closed case, I have two different sets of oscillators, right? I have the left moving and the right moving oscillators to consider. These are these operators that I called L0 and L0 tilde yesterday. There's a typo here. One of these L0s shouldn't have a tilde on it. Okay, so you do that. You've got the Hamiltonian. The second part now is to go and figure out what the Poisson brackets are and write the prescription to canonical quantum commutators. So you figure out what the momentum is conjugate to this string embedding field, and then just use the Poisson brackets, work it out for each mode. Each mode has to satisfy the Poisson bracket, and you should arrive at these canonical quantum commutators. So remember, x0 and p0 were the center of mass, position, and momentum of the string, and you see that they just satisfy the usual canonical commutation relations. The alphas and alpha tildes, these are the oscillatory modes, satisfy this type of an algebra, which we'll deal with in a moment. And the alphas and alpha tildes commute among each other. So the left and right moving sectors of the string commute with each other. Okay, so you have those. So now you're off. And these are just very straightforward commutation relations. They're just what you would get in a free field theory. In particular, you can see from the middle commutation relation here that after some rescaling of these oscillators, what you have is just some quantum mechanical raising and lowering operators for the ordinary harmonic oscillator. Okay, so this after you rescale, this relation looks like this. Just a harmonic oscillator, and again, no surprise, it's a free field theory, and free fields are quantized using harmonic oscillators. So we know right away what the Hilbert space looks like. Okay, so given, I'll just quickly remind you, you're given these harmonic oscillator commutation relations. The Hilbert space is a Fock space, which you build up from some vacuum. You build it up by action of the creation operators, and you form a basis of states of eigenstates of the number operator. So we have some normalized vacuum state, which is annihilated by the A's, these lowering operators. A general state N is created from the vacuum by applications of the creation operator, and the states are orthonormal, and they're eigenstates of the number operator, A dagger A. Okay? Very simple, very simple. There's a slight technicality I should probably mention here, is that what I'm saying here is strictly speaking only true for the oscillator modes that lie along the spatial directions of your target space. There are also light-like oscillators, the thing with a zero label. And they actually are bad in the sense that they give you a harmonic oscillator algebra, but one with a minus one sitting up here. So they give you a harmonic oscillator algebra with the wrong sign, and this is bad for the quantum theory because it gives you negative norm states and things like this. We're not going to worry about those type of things right now because in the end they would all be removed after we impose the mass shell constraints. So I just mentioned that in passing, that it's a slight technicality that one has to worry about. Okay, so those are the oscillatory modes. Now the zero modes, as I said, they were canonically conjugate, so you know what their Hilbert space looks like. It's just a space panned by the usual plane waves, that is the eigenstates of the momentum operator. It's a space of L2 functions. So the total Hilbert space is just built on these types of states that have a definite center of mass momentum K and which are annihilated by all the positive frequency oscillators of the string. And that's it. That's the physical Hilbert. That's the Hilbert space of the string. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to take the operators that we have, take these mode expansions, and promote these two-dimensional fields to quantum operators. Now when we do that, we have to choose, of course, an ordering prescription of the operators. And the standard prescription when you're dealing with a harmonic oscillator is to choose a normal ordering prescription. You take all of the lowering operators of the oscillator and place them to the right. So we'll do that. Take normal ordering. And let's look at now these mode operators, Ln. These Lns, remember, appeared in the mode expansion of the energy momentum tensor of the field theory. So the Ln's look like this, and if n, as long as n is non-zero, see, as long as n is non-zero, the two operators appearing here commute with each other. As long as n is non-zero. They commute with each other, so there's no problem at all. It's straightforward to just move all the lowering operators to the right, and these are fine, no problem when they're promoted to quantum operators. What you have to worry about, however, is what these operators look like when n is equal to zero. Okay? So you see, when n is equal to zero, now these two operators no longer commute with each other. So when you move all of the lowering operators to the right, you get a zero-point energy, just like you get for the ordinary quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator. So L0, remember L0 from the first exercise is essentially the Hamiltonian, looks like this. This is the normal ordered form now. And there's an extra shift that I call epsilon naught. And epsilon naught is given by this formula here. And that's just the total zero point or the Casimir energy of the system. So well, let's look at this for a minute. Now there's a D-2 over here. The D-2... we're working in D space-time dimensions, and so that means we have D family, infinite families of harmonic oscillators. Now, when we come to eventually impose the mass shell constraints, we'll see that that'll reduce the number of degrees of freedom from D to D-2. So I've just put that in by hand from the onset. So that's why there's a D-2 rather than a D appearing in this formula. And the 1/2 here is, of course, just the usual normal ordering constant of a single harmonic oscillator. Pardon me?
I'm just wondering how you know what that epsilon is. I mean, it depends what ordering you start off with.
Yeah, you could show that it's all equivalent. I mean, I'm choosing normal ordering, and then I'm going to choose a regularization of epsilon naught.
Yeah, no, I know, but...
That's right. I mean, the point is it's a zero-point energy, and in the end, it's not a physical quantity anyway. I mean, it's just a prescription, but I have to follow things through consistently. As long as I do that consistently throughout my calculations, I'm okay. But in the end, this is not a physical quantity. Okay? Something that depends on ordering, of course, shouldn't be a physical quantity. Well, you could, but you have to tell me what ordering you've chosen for that. And then do all your calculations with that ordering of your operators. I find it much more convenient to use normal ordering, where all of the lowering operators are placed to the right. Okay, so there's this epsilon naught. Now, of course, there's this sum from n equals 1 to infinity of n. That diverges, of course. And this diverges because I have infinitely many harmonic oscillators in my system. But again, this is just standard quantum field theory. Right? The Casimir energy in quantum field theory always diverges because you have infinitely many degrees of freedom in quantum field theory. So we just do what we do in quantum field theory. We'll regulate it. We'll regulate it in such a way that we get a finite answer. Okay? The standard prescription in field theory would be to use zeta function regularization. So I write this quantity epsilon naught in this way, in terms of some function known as the Riemann zeta function, which is defined by this series. This function has a well-defined analytical continuation for the values that we need. You can work out what some of its values are. The one we're going to need, of course, is zeta minus 1, which is minus 1/12. And with that, we get this formula for our Casimir energy. Okay. So that's a point we're going to need soon, but I stress again that it's not a physical quantity, but it's something I need to keep track of in my calculations. So I'll give you another exercise. It's just still working with this simple canonical quantization. This is just to work out what the angular momentum of the system looks like. So again, take the Polyakov action in the conformal gauge and work out what the angular momentum operators look like, just using your standard knowledge from quantum field theory. And you find they look like this. So the zero mode piece here, the center mass piece, is the usual angular momentum operator, and then you have this contribution from all these oscillatory modes. Then take this and the canonical commutation relations and show that this operator, along with the zero mode momenta, satisfy the defining relations of the Poincaré algebra, as they should. And then finally show that the LNs commute with the angular momentum operators, and that's going to be an important property because it'll tell us later on that the string states, the physical string states that we've constructed, form multiplets of the Lorentz group. So the string states will be Lorentz invariant, again, as they should be. Okay, this is just some little calculations to get a handle on some of this stuff. So that's canonical quantization. So that's canonical quantization. We breezed through it fairly simply. Now what we have to do is go and impose the mass shell constraints. Remember, it's a free field theory, except it's got constraints. So let's do that, and this is where we're going to build up now what the physical states are. So we have this huge Hilbert space of states, and what we want to do is now impose the mass shell constraints at the level of these quantum states. So we're going to truncate our Hilbert space down to some subspace, and we'll call that the subspace of physical string states. Okay, so another exercise. Just use again the oscillator algebra, the definition of these LNs, and work out what commutation relations they satisfy. They close to an infinite dimensional Lie algebra called the Virasoro algebra, whose commutation relations look like this. There's a piece here that depends on the L's. That's the easy one to get, actually, in this calculation. The hard piece to get is this term here. Note that this term is just a constant. It's just a C number term. The number that appears in this algebra is often referred to as the central charge of the Virasoro algebra. In this case, the central charge just coincides with the space-time dimension d. Okay, this is the hard piece to get in this calculation. And this term, this extra constant term that appears here, is referred to as the conformal anomaly. It is what, remember, yesterday I talked about the conformal invariance of the classical string theory, and it turns out that generically this conformal invariance becomes anomalous at the quantum level. So this term represents the breaking of the classical conformal invariance at the quantum level. So that's often referred to as the conformal anomaly. Right, so we're going to need to use these commutation relations will help us in our calculation of the physical string states, so let's now go and construct them. So by definition, the physical string states are those which obey these Virasoro constraints that I wrote down yesterday, that the components of the energy-momentum tensor vanish. And now, I treat the energy-momentum tensor as a set of operators acting on my string states. So I'm imposing these Virasoro constraints now at the operatorial level. So the first constraint I impose is the zero-mode constraint that comes from the Virasoro constraints. So there's L0, the Hamiltonian. Here's the normal ordering again, subtracted off. And I demand that just annihilate a physical state. And similarly, for the higher frequency L's, I demand that Ln annihilate the physical state as well. Now there's a subtlety, of course, because if you look at this commutation relation, because of this central term here, it's of course not possible to impose this last constraint on both the positive and negative frequency modes. You can't impose it for both n greater than 0 and n less than 0. You can only impose it on one set because of the central term in this commutator. But we'll do that. We'll just impose it on the positive frequency modes. And this is again nothing new to string theory. This is the standard Gupta-Bleuler prescription for imposing mass shell constraints in quantum electrodynamics. Right. Okay, so now we're going to go and construct the spectrum of physical string states using these relations here. We'll start with open strings. Yeah.
The energy-momentum tensor function of the Virasoro operator?
Well, it is. It is the Virasoro. The Virasoro operators are the mode in the mode expansion of the energy-momentum tensor.
For example, T0 is L0 minus.
I wrote it down in yesterday's lecture. It was almost one of the last things I said, is that the energy, the components, there was T plus minus and T minus plus. And I had mode expansions for them. And the coefficients of the mode expansions were these Virasoro operators. Okay, and the Virasoro operators, remember, are given in terms of these oscillator modes of the strings, the alphas. So we'll start with open strings, because open strings, there's only one sector, right? Closed strings have a left-moving and right-moving sector. But I'll start with the case of open strings, because then I'll be able to construct everything for the closed string essentially by just taking two copies of the open string and gluing them together for the left and right movers. Okay, so let's look at what the first constraint gives us. The constraint L0 equals A, acting on a physical state, gives us the following relation. It actually gives us a mass shell relation. So it gives us a formula for the mass squared, which is minus the square of the zero mode oscillators, or the minus the square of the center of mass momentum. And you work it out using the expression for L0 in terms of the string oscillators. You find that it's given by this formula here, where n is just a number operator. In this context, it's called the level number. So it's the sum of the string oscillators like this, or you can rewrite it in terms of these ordinary harmonic oscillators. So the an dagger dot an would be the usual quantum mechanical number operator. But this is the level number, some non-negative integer, and it gives us this mass shell condition. Okay? So now what we'll do is we'll start looking at what the physical strings states look like, starting from the lowest value of n and working our way up. So we'll start with n equals 0. So n equals 0 is the ground state. Does that formula increases with n, so the smallest possible value is when n is equal to 0. When n is equal to 0, it means that these number operators all have to kill the state. So the state has to be annihilated by all of these alphas, all of the lowering operators. And there's a unique state which satisfies that. So I write it like this. It's the state that has some momentum k, some center of mass momentum, but has no oscillator excitations. That's the ground state. So now you use the mass shell formula up there. Put n equals 0. Remember, A is a positive constant. And you find that this state has negative mass squared. And that's, of course, bad. That's bad. This is a tachyon, right? This is a particle that moves faster than the speed of light. And its presence in the spectrum of string states indicates that the vacuum is unstable. And you've been hearing lectures now on tachyons in the context of unstable D-brains. And nowadays, we know how to deal with the tachyon using various techniques. But I'm going to take the old-fashioned approach that the tachyon's a bad thing that we eventually want to get rid of. Now, this turns out to be a sickness of the bosonic string, and it's going to be one of our prime motivations tomorrow for introducing supersymmetry into this system and dealing with superstrings. So given that fact, I'm going to just forget about the tachyon right now and plug along and look at the rest of the string spectrum. So the ground state is unstable. It's bad, but we'll see how to deal with it tomorrow. So let's go to the next one. Let's go to the first excited level. So we'll put n equal to 1 in this formula. So n equal to 1. This means that this number operator here has to be equal to 1. And again, there's an almost unique way to do that. You have to excite exactly one of these oscillators. So you have to write down a state that's created by one of the alphas. Now remember, we have D space-time index. So that means I'm also free to dot these alphas in with some vector, some polarization vector. So the most general n equals 1 state looks like this. It carries some polarization vector zeta and some center of mass momentum k. Okay, now we go to the Virasoro constraints. They give us a formula for the mass squared, which looks like this, just putting in n equals 1. And now let's look at the rest of these constraints. What do they tell us? Let's first look at this constraint for little n equal to 1. Okay, now that's a simple calculation where you use the definition of L1, use the fact that the vacuum is annihilated by all of the positive frequency oscillators, and then use the commutation relations of the alphas. So you do that. So L1 on this state, you can show, looks like this. This is all that survives in the mode expansion of L1, okay? Because everything higher than the index 1 here will just kill this state automatically. So this is simple to get. And then to get from here to here, you just use the commutation relation between alpha 1 and alpha minus 1. And you'll find this formula here. So over here, we have the number k dot zeta. This must vanish by the physical state constraints. So this implies that the polarization and the momentum of this state have to be orthogonal vectors. Okay, so that was looking at the first constraint here. Now what you do is you start looking at the higher constraints. You put little n equal to 2, equal to 3, and so on. I'm not going to do any of those calculations. They get a little cumbersome, as you can imagine. But you can do them. And what you deduce is the following. You find, actually, that if this constant A, this normal ordering constant A, is not equal to 1, then all of the states, all of the higher states, turn out to be unphysical. Namely, they either have negative norms, so that's a non-unitary phenomenon, or they, again, contain tachyons. So what we do is we fix the normal ordering constant to 1. We fix A equal to 1, because that's the only thing that you'll find when you do these calculations that gives you physically sensible results. Now remember, A was equal to this quantity, this D minus 2 over 24, and from this formula you can now fix the space-time dimension. You find that D is equal to 26. So this is the well-known bosonic critical dimension of space-time. This constraint, the way I've sort of presented it, I've presented it in this way to really streamline it, because there's actually a bigger story behind this. This is really the critical dimension of space-time that kills the conformal anomaly. Okay? You can see that if you use a path integral approach to the bosonic string using the Polyakov action. And this is, in fact, the way that Polyakov presented this result. But that would take us into too many technicalities, and I don't want to go through all the technical details of really how to arrive at it. But you can think of it in this heuristic way, that this fixing D to this critical dimension is what eliminates all the unphysical properties of the string spectrum. Okay, so we'll staying still with this first excited level. Then another simple exercise. These are very simple things to do. So we introduce a state called the spurious state. So you take the vacuum state and you act on it with the operator L minus 1. Okay? Remember, L minus 1 on a physical state is not 0. Only L1 would be. So you just show various things. You show that the state can be written in this form. This is just a simple, so this means the n equals 1 state whose polarization vector coincides with the momentum vector. This is just an exercise in using the oscillator representation of this Virasoro operator. You show that it's orthogonal to any physical state. You take any state satisfying the mass shell constraints that I had on the other overhead and prove that this state is orthogonal to any one of those states. And then finally show that the action of L1 on this state looks like this. Okay, we'll use that in a minute. So what do we have now? We fixed A to 1. So now we have a state. Look at the mass shell relation over here. We have a state. I put A equal to 1 here. That state's massless. So it's a massless state. And it satisfies this condition, this relation here, between the polarization vectors. The polarization vector and the momentum. Okay? So what does that do? So generically, this state would have 26, D equals 26, independent degrees of freedom. But now I've imposed two constraints on the momentum, and that eliminates 2. So it has D minus 2, or 24, independent polarization states. All right? And there is a well-known thing, and of course it has spin 1. It's a spin 1 with respect to its transformation under the Lorentz group. And now we know a particle that does this, right? We know a particle. If we take a Maxwell field, a photon field, or a Yang-Mills field in 26 space-time dimensions, we know that that describes a massless spin 1 particle with 24 independent states. So this state looks like a photon. To make that more precise, we should see some notion of gauge invariance. If this is a photon state, then there should be some way of imposing a gauge invariance on this. And indeed there is, and this is where this so-called spurious state in the previous exercise comes into play. It's a physical state. It's a physical state. And it's null. That just means it's orthogonal to any other state. So what we'll do is, given this fact, it's physical, it's orthogonal to any other physical state in my Hilbert space, and that means I can should impose some equivalence relation. Namely, that if I take any physical state, that should be invariant under adding to it some multiple of the spurious state. Because if I do that, because this state is physical and it's null, this will not affect any expectation values that I compute. Any amplitudes that are computed using these physical states will not be affected by a shift like this. So I impose some equivalence relation. Now you use the exercise, essentially. Use this exercise, the relations you've derived here, and you can show that this condition is equivalent to the following equivalence relation on the polarization vectors. This just means that the polarization of a state should be identified under a shift of the momentum of the state. So this is for this particular n equals 1 physical state. And that might not look so familiar, but this is really just the momentum space gauge transformation. Okay, the k mu you can think of as the derivative of some function. So this is just a gauge symmetry. This is just the momentum space manifestation of a gauge symmetry. So there's a U of 1 gauge symmetry here, and we'll conclude from this that the level 1 state describes the 24 independent polarizations of a massless photon field. Okay, so there's the photon coming out in the spectrum of string states. Okay, I'll say a word or two about the higher level states of the open string later on, but let's now go and look at the analog of closed strings. Okay, so we'll go look at the closed string states up to the first excited level. So, closed strings, well, we take two copies of the open string, one for the left movers and the right movers, and then we just have to slightly change the definition of the zero mode oscillators. Okay, they have a slightly different proportionality constant to the center of mass momentum. Again, we do this usual thing. We're going to fix A equal to 1. We impose mass shell constraints. So on the L zeros, they look like this. Except now, I have independent mass shell constraints in both the left moving and the right moving sector. So I have two of them here. So I can take these conditions and I can add and subtract them. Take the two conditions and it's convenient to add and subtract them. When you add them, you get a mass shell relation. You can just again use the definition of what the mode expansions of the Virasoro operators look like. You get this mass shell relation and you get what's called the level matching condition from subtracting them. So N is the number operator for the oscillators in the right moving sector. N tilde is the number operator for the oscillators in the right moving sector. And what the level matching condition tells you is that the level numbers in the left and right moving sectors have to be the same. And then the mass shell condition is similar to what I wrote down before. So let's just do what we did before. We'll start putting in different values of n into the mass shell relation and start looking at what states we get. So put n equals 0 first. Put n equals 0 into this formula. What do we get? Again, it's the state that there's a unique state that satisfies that condition. It's the state that has no oscillator excitation. So again, it just carries some momentum k. However, again, the mass shell relation tells you that the state has negative mass squared, and again you get the tachyon. The tachyon's sitting there, but we'll cure that tomorrow. Let's plug along and not worry about this unstable particle. The next excited level is where both the left and right moving level numbers are equal to 1. And similarly to before, the essentially unique way to do that is to insert exactly one oscillator state. But now you can do it in both the left and right moving sectors. So the most general state with n equals n tilde equals 1 looks like this. And again, because these carry Lorentz indices up here, I'm free to contract them with some polarization tensor zeta. So now, of course, it's a rank 2 tensor. Okay, so that's the most general excited state. Let's go and do what we did before. We go and write down the mass shell constraints. Again, there's two constraints for both the left and right movers, which looks like this. Do the calculation analogously to what I did before, and you find that these polarization tensors have to satisfy this contraction condition with the momentum. And again, putting n equals 1 into the mass shell relation tells you that this describes a massless particle. So what is this particle? It turns out that this tensor actually is going to encode 3 different particles. To see why that is, so this polarization tensor is just a generic tensor. It has no symmetry properties at all. No constraint on it. So what you do is you decompose it into pieces that are constrained, either by symmetry, anti-symmetry, or a trace-free condition, or what have you. More formally, this means that we should decompose this tensor according to the irreducible representations of what's called the Little group. We're in 26-dimensional space-time, and it's known that the Little group, which is the group SO24 in this case, classifies massless states. So massless particles are classified by this group. What does this mean? Well, remember what I'm doing over here. I'm taking two vectors of the Lorentz group, and I'm multiplying them together. I'm tensoring them together. So from a group theoretical perspective, what I'm doing is I'm looking at the vector representation of SO24, and I'm taking the tensor product of those two representations. Now what I want to do is I want to break that up into irreducible representations. And it's known how to do that. That's simple. There are three irreducible representations that it decomposes into. There's what's called the symmetric, the anti-symmetric, and then there's just the trivial, the singlet representation. So you break that up. And each of these irreducible representations corresponds to a massless particle. So there are 3 massless particles that appear here. If you don't like group theory, you just do it directly. Take this tensor and split it up into pieces. The first piece you can split it up into is its symmetric traceless part. This is the symmetric traceless part of this rank 2 tensor. This is its anti-symmetric part. And then this is just something that's left over. Okay. But this is a singlet, right? This is a singlet because it's just got a trace here. So all of these 3 things, of course, sum up to just give zeta. And now you group them. The traceless symmetric part I'll call G mu nu. The anti-symmetric part I'll call B mu nu. And then the leftover piece I'll call phi. So this G mu nu corresponds to this symmetric representation. It has spin 2 because it's a rank 2 tensor that transforms under the Lorentz group. And that's we're going to identify as the graviton. It's going to be the space-time metric. The anti-symmetric piece, that corresponds to the anti-symmetric representation here. It also has spin 2. And that's called the Neville-Schwarz B field. And the trivial piece here, that corresponds to the singlet representation here, it has spin 0 because it lies in the singlet. And that's a field called the dilaton. So what are these fields? In particular, why do I call this a graviton? Well, again, you can go and introduce a special spurious state for the closed string, and then go through this gauge invariance argument that I went through when I found the photon state. So you impose an equivalence relation using the spurious states, and you find, again, that you get gauge transformations, momentum space versions of gauge transformations. So G should be identified with its shift under any transformation of this form. And this is just the gauge transformation, the diffeomorphism transformation of a metric tensor, an infinitesimal one. Okay? So this is exactly the object I should think of as a graviton, graviton state. And B has a similar transformation rule, except, of course, it's got a minus sign here because it's anti-symmetric.
So lambda is divergence free.
Pardon me?
Lambda is divergence free.
Lambda is divergence free. Lambda is just a, lambda is just any. I guess yeah. I guess I want it divergence free. Yeah, sure. Okay, so let's go through what are these things. Well, this just tells you that G should be thought of as the graviton state, and in particular the vacuum expectation value of G, of this metric, fixes the space-time geometry. This tells us what the space-time geometry is. On the other hand, the vacuum expectation value of the dilaton determines the string coupling constant. This determines the coupling constant that appears when I write down the string perturbation expansion. This is not an obvious thing, of course. It can be derived using what are known as vertex operators. We'll discuss vertex operators soon, although I won't show you how to get this, but this is how you would show this result. Now, what about B? What does this transformation rule for B mean? In fact, it means a very important thing. The gauge transformation rule for the B field is just a higher rank generalization of what you would write down for the Maxwell field, what you would write down for a vector potential. Okay, so this would be the gauge transformation rule for a vector potential. And you know that because of the gauge transformation, you can minimally couple charged particles to vector potentials. In other words, charged particles are sources for vector potentials because they couple minimally through terms like this. This is just an integral over a particle world line and then contracted with the vector potential. Right? That's what this means. Now, similarly here, this gauge transformation rule it's some kind of gauge invariance, but it now means that the strings, these strings that we're talking about, are sources for the B field. Namely, there's a version of the minimal coupling I can write down for this B field, and it looks like this. You can use it, this is an integral now over the string world sheet. These are the string embedding fields, and I just contract with the two-dimensional anti-symmetric tensor, and I have this coupling to the strings. Okay, so that's an important thing, that the significance of the B field is that the strings provide a source for this B field.
Why does the gauge transformation imply that?
Well, I mean, the point is that this is going to be a gauge invariant quantity. This is a minimal coupling. All right, and you need a two-dimensional object to do that. I mean, to put it a little more precisely, which we'll do in 5 minutes or so, this is what the term that will appear in the vertex operator for this state. It will be the right operator that creates the state corresponding to the B field. Okay, now that's all I'm going to really say about the detailed construction of string states. There's a bigger, better story here, but that's all we're going to talk about. So let's just summarize what we've seen. And the best way to think about what we've seen so far is really an interplay between world sheet and space-time degrees of freedom. On the level of the world sheet, we saw two types of strings. We had open strings and we had closed strings. And they each gave us something complementary. The open strings we see are intimately related to gauge theory. They gave us a gauge field. On the other hand, closed strings are intimately tied to the space-time geometry. In other words, they gave us gravity. And this is a very basic manifestation of the gauge theory gravity correspondence. Because if you can somehow get these two sectors mixed up, then you can have a way of coupling gauge theory to gravity. The higher levels, n greater than or equal than 2, are all massive. They're all massive, they're stable, We won't go through them in any detail, but the important thing to note is that there's infinitely many of them. There's an infinite tower of massive particles.
The only thing is theory for geometric potential massless is a cavity theory. I mean, how do you measure the G-mu gives cavity?
How does what does G-mu give?
Yeah. Why does G-mu give cavity and not some other stuff?
Well, not some other stuff. Well, it's, I mean, I showed you that it had the right transformation rule, first of all. Okay, it transformed the right way. If I think of these gauge transformations as diffeomorphisms, then that's exactly the way that G should transform. That's the simplest way to see it. I mean, you see this, of course, in other ways when you go and write down effective actions and things like that. But this is the important message, is that I should really think of the things coming from the closed string sector as gravitational objects. Okay, that's the string spectrum. What I'm going to do for the rest of today's lecture is just describe some more formal aspects of the quantization of the bosonic string. The first thing I want to go into is that, well, you know that in quantum field theory, that any reasonable quantum field theory has an operator state correspondence that provides a one-to-one mapping between operators and physical states. And what I want to do is describe how that works in string theory. So this will introduce the notion of vertex operators. So what's a vertex operator? Well, what we'll do first is we'll take the mode expansions for the string fields. And what we want to do is reinterpret them now as Laurent series expansions in the complex plane. That's the first thing we do. So how do we do that? Well, we take the world sheet for the closed string or the open string. Remember, the closed string, it was an infinite cylinder. For the open string, it was an infinite strip. What we do is we do a Wick rotation of the world sheet time coordinate tau. So this gives the world sheet Euclidean signature. It's now a Euclidean surface. And then we define a coordinate transformation to the following complex coordinates. Z is e to the tau minus I sigma. Okay? So these are the string world sheets here, and in the complex Z plane, they now look like this. The closed string world sheet, the infinite cylinder, gets mapped to the entire complex plane, minus the origin. The strip, on the other hand, gets mapped only to the upper complex half plane. And you can trace out, of course, what tau and sigma are here. Sigma is just the angle in the complex plane, right? It just appears as the phase of Z, so it forms concentric circles around the origin of the complex plane. And tau just corresponds to the radial directions in the complex plane. It just gives you the modulus of this complex number Z. And you can see why, then, for closed strings, sigma goes through the whole interval 0 to 2 pi, so it maps onto the whole complex plane. But for open strings, we restrict it from 0 to pi, so it only goes over half the range. Right. So why do I want to do that? Well, the reason is that if I use this interpretation, the mode expansions can now be written in this form. I can write them as derivatives acting on these string embedding fields. Okay, they're derivatives acting on them with this definition. They look like this. So they look like Laurent series expansions. And with that, you can now use what you know from complex analysis. You can actually invert these expansions using the Cauchy integral formula. You invert it and represent the oscillators in terms of the string embedding fields in this form, with these contour integrals that encircle the origin of the complex Z plane. So alphas, remember, alphas are things that act on the vacuum and create string states. So this formula tells us that the states created by alpha minus n are related to insertions of derivatives of the string embedding fields at the origin of the complex z-plane, right? Because that's what these contour integrals give you, essentially. They're related to insertions to nth derivatives of these string embedding fields at the origin. And the picture of what happens at the origin is up here, right? The insertion of some operator at the origin of the complex z-plane means you've taken tau to minus infinity. So it corresponds in the original world sheet picture to a physical state coming in from the infinite world sheet past. All right, so those are the vertex operators. Let's look at some examples. Let's look at some examples of this. So first example is the tachyon vertex operator. So we could think of it roughly as the operator which just pins a string somewhere down in space-time. So it's formally some delta function that looks like this. In Fourier space, of course, I need the Fourier transform of this. And it's the operator which is associated to the tachyon state. Now remember, this tachyon state is essentially a plane wave. There are no oscillators here. It looks like a plane wave. And that corresponds to the insertion of this operator here. And these circles denote the normal ordering prescription on these operators. So this is the basic operator that corresponds to the vacuum state of the string theory.
Can you relate that to what you were just saying about the...
Well, that, what I'm just saying really corresponds to the excited states, right? So the alpha, these are the, when I start creating, and that's what I'm getting to here. So I've just shown you, I'm really showing you how to get this basic plane wave first, which we know is the ground state. Okay, and you, I mean, the reason why this corresponds can be checked by various things. You just look at how this state behaves under a translation under X, for instance. And you find that the same thing happens here. They have the same properties. So now, indeed, let's start putting in... excited states. And I'll use this prescription here. So what we do now is we now look at the closed string level 1 vertex operators. Remember, the state looked like this with some generic polarization vector. If I want to excite the state using these oscillators, the prescription tells me that I should use these derivatives. And these derivatives now have to be multiplied by the basic object that appears for the ground state. And so these are the operators, the vertex operators that I'll call them, which emit or absorb the basic gravitational fields of the closed string. Finally, let's look at the open string level 1 operator. So that's this string. That's this corresponds to this state. The corresponding operator will describe the emission or absorption of a photon. So it looks like this. Now, what happens here now is, remember, if I have the closed string mode expansion, the way to get the mode expansion for the open string is to just identify reflections of the left moving and right moving closed string expansion. So I just reflect them onto each other. And in the complex Z plane, this means that I should identify Z with its complex conjugate. Remember, it was identifying sigma with minus sigma, so now I identify Z with Z complex conjugate. And that has the effect of restricting the integration that would normally appear to the line where Z is equal to Z bar, right? And that's just the real line in the complex Z plane. In other words, it's the boundary of the upper complex half plane, so it's just the boundaries of my open string. So this is an integral, and L here is the coordinate on the boundary of the open string. And D parallel denotes a derivative which runs along that boundary. It runs tangential to the boundary. So that's the open string of level 1 vertex operator. And it's completely consistent of the fact that this operator is just associated with the endpoints of the string. So roughly speaking, the photon lives at the endpoints of the string. Now, if you were to actually go and you could do a very simple classical calculation where you work out what is the canonical momentum associated with the endpoints of the string, and you'll deduce that the endpoints of the open string actually move at the speed of light. Okay? Classically, they move at the speed of light, so that's completely consistent with the fact that in the quantum theory, I should think of them as having a photon attached to them. Okay, those are vertex operators. What I now want to do briefly is tell you some very elementary facts with no proof about the string perturbation series. So this is very heuristic and non-technical. Now, so how do we do perturbation theory in quantum field theory? Well, we write down Feynman diagrams. So some simple examples are here. The Feynman diagrams can be associated with the world lines of particles that move in space-time. And the interaction vertices are singular junctions where these world lines meet. So very roughly, I can think of over here, in the context that I'm going to be speaking, that the usual ultraviolet divergences that I encounter in quantum field theory come from singular junctions of the particle world lines. When these particles meet, they meet at singular points in space-time. Now, on the other hand, the Feynman diagrams in string theory are quite different. Some examples are written here. So this corresponds to four strings doing a tree-level scattering. These are closed strings. Okay, so here's your closed string. Here's another one. They're coming together, joining, and then separating again. This is a one-loop two-string scattering. There's some hole now in this surface. So these are surfaces, remember, world sheets of strings. This is a one-loop, a string coming, doing something at one-loop order. So this is a hole, or it's also called a handle on the world sheet. And the main point is that these are smooth. These are smooth two-dimensional surfaces because the string is an extended object. So two strings come together, they have a smooth interaction. This is a very heuristic way to see how string theory cures the ultraviolet divergences that quantum gravity would normally contain. The loop amplitudes turn out to be much smoother than what you would get in quantum field theory and are therefore UV finite.
Has that been proved rigorously to all orders?
This can be proved, this can be proved when you put in the infinite tower of massive string states. Okay, what I'm saying is not a proof. I mean, I'm doing it simply. The whole point is that when you include this whole tower of massive string states, all the UV divergences are smoothed out. Is it true to all orders? Has it been proved to all orders? I don't think so. Certainly not for the superstring, but for the bosonic string, I'm not entirely sure. Right. Now, there's another important thing to note about the interactions here. Is that, remember, we never ever put in interactions into this theory, right? We always stress that we have a free two-dimensional field theory. The interactions are not something we put in. They're chosen by the free theory. They're in these diagrams that I write down. And in fact, when I start drawing holes in these surfaces, this is just adding some topology to my theory. So the interactions here are a consequence of world sheet topology rather than of singular points where particles interact. Okay? So there are no arbitrary interactions chosen here. The interactions are built in to this theory already. Well, yeah, I'm only dealing with oriented things here, but you can indeed have non-oriented strings. And I'll say a bit more of that probably in lecture 4, but strictly speaking, everything I want to do right now is when I have oriented strings. Okay, so let's look at a schematic representation of a typical string amplitude. Again, as I did before, it's convenient to wick rotate the world sheet time direction to Euclidean signature. So now, remember this metric that appeared yesterday in the Polyakov action is positive definite. The reason why I want to do that is just because mathematically life is easier. The geometry of two-dimensional Euclidean surfaces is a long-solved problem in mathematics. I know how to classify them. I know how to write everything down. So I can do that. And then let me just quote for you what the typical structure of a string scattering amplitude looks like. So we have a path integral. We take the Boltzmann weight with the Polyakov action. Okay, now remember, the Polyakov action generically depends on both the string embedding field and a world sheet metric on the string world sheet M. Okay, so I have to integrate over all of these world sheet metrics as well as the string embedding fields. So this is the basic vacuum part. And then to describe the scattering of some states, some excited states, I insert vertex operators. So the quantities here are insertions of vertex operators in the bulk, one for each type of particle that I have, state that I have. And then these are all the insertions on the boundary. So these correspond to closed string states. These correspond to open string states. But now there's this important conformal invariance of the theory, at least in the critical string dimension.
Why don't you have the square root of gamma in the integration where the vertex operator?
You want a square root gamma there, right. You should probably have a square root gamma there, yeah. Yeah. Make it covariant, yeah. Thanks. Now, in the critical dimension, we have this conformal invariance, and this amplitude should reduce to an integral over only conformally inequivalent world sheets, right? Just like in a gauge theory, the amplitudes I compute should be restricted to only gauge inequivalent configurations. That the nice thing here is that that turns out to be a finite dimensional space. It's called the moduli space of this surface M. And its dimension is given by this formula. It depends on what's called the genus, or the number of handles of this surface, the number of boundaries it has, and then the number of closed and open string state insertions. So these amplitudes up here reduce to finite dimensional integrals. And that's a very nice feature of these scattering amplitudes. Okay, so the last quick topic today is, I told you how to get photons in the picture, that is how to get a U of 1 gauge field into it. The question now comes up, can we get non-abelian gauge fields? And there's an old construction of that, going back to the dual resonance days, and it's the things that you insert are known as Chan-Payton factors. So what are these? What we do is we take our open string, okay, we're looking at the photon. We take the open string and we attach non-dynamical degrees of freedom to the endpoints of the string. Okay? In other words, we give them a label I and J. I and J run from 1 up to some integer n. We'll denote the corresponding state schematically like this. And we're putting things in by hand. The key word here, though, is that they're non-dynamical. In other words, I just declare that the Hamiltonian of these things that I'm adding to the endpoints be zero, so that that whatever state I start with these labels will remain there for all time. Then what we can do is we can take any open string state and decompose it into a basis corresponding to these labels. And these basis matrices, these n by n matrices, are known as Chan-Payton factors. Okay. So it's just a construction I'm putting in hand. Heuristically, you can think that you're putting quarks on the endpoints of the strings. Although you shouldn't think of it physically, because these are not the strings that bind quarks together. Now, if you work out amplitudes using the Chan-Payton factors, what you find is that they contain traces of these matrices lambda that I've written here. So you can look at, for instance, a simple tree-level scattering amplitude of four strings. These are oriented strings, so these have directions. And so what happens here? Now, if you look at, say, string 1, okay, this is open string 1, it has some label on its endpoint here. Now, because these are non-dynamic, these labels are non-dynamical, the label that I have at the right end of string 1 must coincide with the label that's at the left end of string 2. Because these labels are non-dynamical. They can't evolve. They can't change abruptly into some other label. So the labels match as you go along here. The left end of 2 is the same as the right end of 1. Left end of 1 same as the right end of 3, and so on, all the way through the diagram. Just remark that this diagram is, of course, equivalent to computing what's called a disk diagram. It's an open string diagram, because I could just take this thing and shape it into a circle, a disk, using a conformal transformation. All it does is changes the area of that object. Okay? So what does this have to do with non-abelian gauge symmetry? This is my last overhead for today. Well, as I said, all of these things have to coincide. And what you do now is you sum over all possible Chan-Peyton factors that are involved in sewing up the ends together in this graph. And you do that, it schematically looks like this. So I'm just writing what the contribution is from these n by n matrices. And indeed, when you do that, because everything matches in the way that I just described, these amplitudes all contain traces of these Chan-Peyton factors. Okay. So they depend only on the traces of them, and that means there's a global unitary symmetry in the theory. It's a global U of n invariance that looks like this. I take the lambdas, and each lambda I rotate by the same unitary matrix like this. The amplitudes depend only on traces, so they'll be invariant under transformations like this. And I can heuristically think of it in this picture that the endpoint over here transforms in the fundamental representation of this U of n group, while the endpoint J, because it's associated with an opposite orientation of the string, transforms in the anti-fundamental representation. I can heuristically think of it like this. Now, similarly, the massless vector vertex operator associated to the state will look like this. It's the same object I had before, but now I just put in these Chan-Peyton factors for these non-dynamical degrees of freedom. And then this also transforms under the adjoint representation of this U of n group. But the point is that here, for each, I can write down this transformation rule for each configuration of the string embedding fields. So for each x mu that I have, I can write down a transformation rule like this that leaves my amplitudes invariant. In other words, I can make this U of n rotation at each point x mu in my spacetime. So I can really think of this now as a local U of n symmetry of the theory. In other words, I can promote this global U of n invariance to a local U of n invariance, and that's a non-abelian gauge symmetry. So in this way, by adding in these Chan-Peyton factors, you can create states that correspond to non-abelian gauge fields. Okay? And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Let's thank the speaker again. We'll reconvene at 10:15.